Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the Scared to Dance podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. Over the course of this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite people about their musical passions past and present. These include people who have DJed our club night as well as those who have created our film nights. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Pat Nevin to the show. Pat played over 660 professional football matches in his career, starting off at Clyde before making moves to Chelsea, Everton and Tranmere Rovers. He played 28 times for Scotland, playing at Euro 92, as well as becoming the chairman of the Professional Footballers Association. Since retiring as a player, he's been the chief executive of Motherwell and is now a successful broadcaster and author. We first met when Scared to Dance was about 6 months old, which is back in early, I think it was February 2010, I think it was. I used to listen to your show on Five Live with Colin Murray and Perry Groves on a Friday night, and music would often come up in conversation. And I remember emailing the show's producer, essentially pitching the Scared to Dance in its very early stages to see if you'd like to come and DJ sometime, because I was aware that you'd done DJing at different clubs and so on in the past. And I remember a few days later, you got back to me and you sent over your phone number and told me to give you a call on a Monday. And I remember you had just come back from a run and you were shaving. And I was slightly terrified of calling you up. Because, as I said, Scared to Dance had been existing for about 6 months. And I think most of the people that DJed at that point were either friends. You know, like I said, it was in these very early stages. So I remember you came down, I think it was the next time you were in London, you came down to the night because you said you wanted to come and see what it was like. And I can distinctly remember you standing at the bar with a glass of red wine, sort of observing what was going on. So what were your observations of Scared to Dance early on?
I immediately liked it. It was quite small then, very laid back. People sitting about originally, then adding a bit of dancing later on. I could see what the concept was and what you could build from it. But there was a lot of things like in Glasgow, not dissimilar things. Like the pop club and things like that. And there was quite a few actually in Glasgow in a kind of similarish vein. None of these clubs are the same. They've got different kind of angles on them. But at the time it was a really nice time. And I had a bunch of friends at the time where I was kind of hanging about with Cameron Obscura and Bernd Sebastian and all the people of the bands up in Glasgow at the time. And they had this real, there was a place called the Winchester Club, which... fantastic. So I'd go and do Scottish version of Match of the Day and then finish there and then straight over to where you could hear some really good music and meet some good friends. There was a place in Newcastle that existed as well, another one in Oxford. But it wasn't as much in London and it was very weird. I thought I should really go and see if this is the right sort of place that I'd like. And immediately I knew you're kind of musical taste and the kind of angle you're coming out, I thought, yeah, coming from the same place here. And it's something that I wasn't thinking of building it because I don't ever think of that. I think, I'm sure you were, but I was thinking, yeah, just kind of go and play some tunes to some mates and next time I come down, I'll bring some of my mates, which I did the second time. I wonder if you know this. You're going to learn some things today. The second time I come down, I brought somebody with me and it was a woman. And she was head of Warner Brothers UK and USA.
I did not know that.
But I just thought, yeah, this is the kind of place that people would quite like. And it was, I quite liked it. So I was looking forward to doing it.
Yeah, well, it's funny you should say that because there weren't that many good club nights around at the time, and which was one of the reasons I ended up starting Scared to Dance. And I always wanted to get other people involved. So I remember the following month you came down and DJed. So how was that for you?
It was good because you never know quite what your audience is. And by the way, that's never changed, has it?
No.
Because the audience changes all the time. So you don't really know what people are going to like. So the first one I thought, actually, if people are going to come along and they know I'm there, I'll just play what I like. Just purely what I like. And then we'll worry about getting people up to dance. So you'll play some odd stuff, some weird stuff, some left field stuff. Because it's kind of, when you know yourself, it's kind of, I wouldn't say easy to get people dancing. But we know what the bangers are. You know how to do that sort of thing. But to play stuff that's, hey, wait a minute, hey, I've not heard that, or hey, wait a minute, does that really fit here? Kind of stuff. That's the stuff that I like mixing in with it. But I, as years ago, so that was the first time I went down there, it was good fun. As I said, DJ before, but I'd kind of not done it for a wee while, for a variety of reasons. And I thought, oh yeah, I'll kind of get back into that. And the reason, the other funny thing about it is you kind of figured it out that I would do that, but nobody knew that I DJed because I kept it quiet. And I didn't do it to make money or to be famous or to be cool. I don't know, because I wanted to meet up with mates now and again and play some good music. It's very loud. And so that's my attitude towards it. But that kind of was blown a wee while later when two things happened. Done a couple of festivals, particularly the Bully 2 festival. And then Twitter happened and that kind of buggered up everything, because you can't do anything now and Twitter will tell the world. So that kind of, the secret was kind of, but we had a bit of a secret for a wee while, which was good.
We did. I remember being at that Bowley and you were wearing a Pains of Being Pure at Heart t-shirt, which was a huge influence on Scared to Dance starting with the other bands like Hello Darling, with my friend Sean Price's record label Fortuna Pop. So yeah, I do remember that fantastic DJ set. So today I would love to dig into your music collection, Pat. You were born and raised in Glasgow to quite a large family. What was the first song that you remember hearing?
First song, I think my mum and dad had some very old records that were kind of, movie themes, movie records like The Big Country and things like that. There was a bit of John Barry stuff going on. My dad was a big Frank Sinatra fan, and rather wonderfully, many years later, I was able to take my dad and my mum to see Sinatra in London, which was fabulous. I tell you, by the way, you have to stop me getting off at tangents, right? You really do. But I'm going to go off at a tangent. All those years later when I was playing for Chelsea and I managed to get tickets for my dad and my mum to come down from Glasgow to see Sinatra. And then at last minute, I got one, you know, a week sort of further up in the gods. Anyway, my mum and dad were down at front, Royal Albert Hall, and I'm really happy. And I'm looking down at them from this higher area thinking, it's great that I've managed to get my dad this, a dream of his, to see him. And I got tapped on my shoulder because I was kind of slightly in the way. Oh God, what's that? Sorry, Frank. Bit late, boy.
Oh, wow.
It was Frank Sinatra. And I was blocking his entrance.
What was your dad's reaction?
Oh, well, he was downstairs. Whereas I was up, didn't get tickets with them. So I was looking down at my mum and dad down in the kind of the expensive seats. And I was up. Mm. And Sinatra was being led in. And I turned around and he's just stood there going, looking at us. Like, sorry, Frank.
So were those early memories of Frank Sinatra, did that kind of filter through?
No, not pivotal. Now I can tell you the filter. The filter first came with my brothers and sisters' music. That's when the filter first came. My early memory, I can remember the late 60s. So the Beatles were everywhere. Stones, Simon Garfunkel, Ellie Rod Stewart, all that stuff has been played in my house. But there's one particular track that kind of jumped at me. This was like before Bowie really started to happen. I remember really early, but I can remember Life on Mars being released, but you didn't know who Bowie was going to become or how important to me, certainly, and most of us. But I remember my big brother Tommy brought a hexagonal album. So it wasn't round. The album wasn't square. It was hexagonal. Or no, eight. One of them. And it was called Through the Past Darkly, Great Sets Volume 2 by the Rolling Stones. And you know, you've got some great tracks on there, you know. But in the midst of all those tracks, there was one that I thought, oh my God, that's different. And it was 2000 Light Years from Home. And it was so different. And I was like, I could have been 7, 8, and thinking, oh, so it doesn't always have to be the kind of the R&B stuff. I wouldn't be able to tell you that at the time. It doesn't need to be this normal chorus, verse, etc. You can get a bit weird. Now, I couldn't have told you then that this was a bit of psychedelia from the Stones. And they didn't really spend a lot of time in that direction. But I remember thinking, I want to find more stuff like that. I really do. And that was a weirdly pivotal song. And you may remember, I've actually played that.
Mm.
I made a mix of that to play It's Scared to Dance. And I don't think many people in the club knew what it was, but it's got a thumping beat when you put a beat behind it and you cut it slightly so you've got the middle eight taken out. All that sort of stuff, right? Which I did. And it really went down a storm. And you're thinking, that's so many years later. But then again, it is a great track, because if you look at, it's in movies. So what's the movie, the Will Smith one? They're kind of Men in Black 2 or 3, it's in, and it sounds brilliant, right? So anyway, that's where the emphasis came from. My brothers and sisters started bringing stuff home. But I was kind of weird. There was sort of nice T-Rexy stuff, or I kind of quite liked our stuff. And then my older brothers moving out to Floyd and Genesis. And that was cleverer. And that was actually quite much, much more interesting than the pop rubbish that you're getting. We look back and always go, oh man, that was mid-70s, you know, Bowie, Gray, T-Rex. Yeah, the rest of it was nonsense, as most chart music is and always has been. So then I went down a kind of real Pink Floyd-y Genesis line, and really kind of loved the kind of mid-period albums of Genesis at the time. I don't hide that fact now. It's not seen as very cool, but I don't care. That's just what I loved at the time. And that... through that, but then kind of Bowie kind of hit, and then it was a period where it was Floyd, Bowie, Genesis, and I kind of loved them all, and I was starting to go to see gigs. I went to see Thin Lizzy live, 77 tour, phenomenal rock band, but really just good tunes. But I was beginning to get into other stuff, and then I had a girlfriend and she introduced me to John Peel, and wow, the life changed.
So just going back a little bit, if the Rolling Stones album was one that was very much borrowed from your older brother's record collection, can you remember what the first album was that you bought?
Well, I can tell you the first single. The first single was, it sounds me trying to be cool, but it's not, because it makes sense. I'm looking for something different. I'm listening to the music that's coming out thinking, yeah, I know what that is. My brothers have all bought that, and I know what that is. I know what that is. And then this song came out that sounded like nothing else, and it was Kraftwerk, and it was Autobahn, and you can't, it's hard to explain to people how different that was from everything else. It was electronic, it was not coming from anywhere else, and people of a certain age talk about the influence and importance of Kraftwerk. You kind of had to be there to know, oh my god, is this where we can go, you know, and influence even like they had in Bowie afterwards, you know, in the kind of Berlin trilogy and all that sort of stuff. So at that point in time, there was, that was the first Kraftwerk, the first single I bought. First album I bought was actually, was a Genesis album that my brothers didn't have, and it was Lamplight Down on Broadway. And how precocious. Double album, concept album. But,
so what age would you have been at this time?
Probably 12, 13, 14. The stuff, I didn't buy albums before that. I didn't need to. I had older brothers and sisters that were buying them all.
So at this point of life, are you training with the Celtic Boys Club?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I loved playing football.
Yeah.
And I was kind of falling madly in love with music as well. I also was a big, big reader, even as a kid. So literature was a kind of thing as well, which was growing all the time. And you're just learning who you are at that point in time. But there was no doubt in my mind that, you know, I adored football. You didn't have headphones in those times, so if you play football, you play football. You're out for a run, you're out for a run. If you listen to music, you sat in and listened to music. You consider that you read the sleeve notes. You've done the whole thing. So at that time, but the football, I'd been playing all my life as a kid. My dad was coach. I'd been training. But I'd never crossed my mind once to be a professional footballer. Never. At no point in time. I just liked playing. And then, you know, 12, 13, I went to Celtic Boys Club, spotted me playing against them. And I played against them. We won 4-1, and I scored a hat-trick. So there was a fairly decent chance they were going to grab me. And they were the top club in Scotland at the time. And then very soon after that, they put me on a schoolboy form, Celtic Football Club. So I'm playing for Celtic Boys Club and Celtic Football Club. And I'm representing Glasgow. And it's still not crossed my mind that you could be a footballer. No idea. No concept of it, because my older brothers and sisters, my older brother Tommy, probably good enough to have made it at a certain level. Michael definitely good enough to make it a good level in professional football. But I knew they were good players, but they and we all went on to higher education. That's what we did in our family. And even though we came from a rough part of Glasgow, That was, we weren't like a lot of other people. We were kind of, mum and dad, although left school when we were 14, very involved in education. So the idea of being a professional footballer would have horrified my mum, because you should go and do a degree. And then in the end, that's what I did, because that's what I thought was a sensible thing to do.
Well, you mentioned that your mum was sort of horrified by the concept of you becoming a professional footballer. How did your dad feel about it? Because I know that he was very encouraging later on, but at that initial stage of sort of 12, 13 years old, and you're playing for the team that you support at a very young age, what was his feelings towards that?
I found out many years later, when I was about 13, my dad told my older brothers he's going to play for his country. And my older brothers would have laughed at it. And he wouldn't have told me, because I'd have been fuming. Don't be big-headed, don't be arrogant, all that sort of stuff. But he'd said that. And if he'd have said it to me, I'd have said, you have no idea, Dad. You haven't got a clue. And I'd have laughed at him. And he was right. And I was wrong. Do you notice I say he's going to play for his country? You notice I didn't say which country that? Dad would absolutely have expected me to play for Ireland. And the rest of the family would have, they would have chosen Ireland. But I'm very much Scottish. I happen to have an Irish passport as well. I'm Irish partially as well, but I'm Scottish. But he kind of spotted it really early that he thought was a bit better than most.
So at this age, things didn't work out with Celtic and you end up at Clyde. How did you feel about that? Did you just sort of grasp opportunity of being a professional footballer, or was it more kind of innocent?
Nothing like that. Nothing like that at all. So, leave Celtic was really weird. I get player of the year at the boys' club, top goal scorer, everything. And then they said, we're going to let you go because we don't think you're big enough and you're not going to make it. And I went, ah, very good. Like, I care.
Mm-hmm.
Day anyway. I'm going to do a degree. Like, I'll just go and support a team from the terrace. I'm very happy with that. No interest. It didn't bother me at all. But I still love playing football. I damnly loved playing. So I ended up after a couple of months going playing with a boys' club called Gartcross United. There's a reason why I tell you this. And it's because I'm playing with this boys' club, and we were pretty good, to be fair. We win every tournament we went in for. And it was this one day, we had a week off, and our manager, David Skinner, said, look, there's a team that want to play us, you know, just for fitness. It's Clyde Reserves. So me and my mate, Brian Sweeney, had a bet, and he was a good player. And quite a few of the players, four in that team eventually went pro. That's how good we were, like. And we had a bet before the game. Whoever scores the best goal buys the other one an album. I've beat about four people and scored, and he's scored a 25-yarder. And we're walking off at the end of the game, laughing our heads off, because we don't care. We're just having a laugh. And there's a wee round guy standing there saying, Do you fancy coming playing with our team? And I went, what? And he goes, Clyde. And I went, oh, actually, no, I'm doing a degree, studying in Glasgow. So, no, I've not really got time. And he went, well, we're part time. It wouldn't get you, it's just two evenings a week, and playing a Saturday wouldn't affect your studies. I went, oh, I don't know, I just really do it for the fun. And he went, we can pay you £35 a week. And I says, where's the pen? He's not pen. And that wee guy was Craig Brown.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he was the manager of Clyde, who went on to be manager of Scotland. And in that moment, so I thought, okay, well, I can do both. I hadn't actually crossed my mind I could do both. And I'll be absolutely honest with you, £35, my idea was, oh my God, we're albums costing £1.99. At that time, how many albums can I buy for £35 a week? Oh my God. So it was great. And then if you win, you get a win bonus as well. So I'm playing football, loving it, still at college, doing my degree with friends, unbelievably happy. So what's there not to like about doing that? And at this point in time, the most important part, think about it, 1980, 81 Glasgow. The music scene is absolutely magnificent.
So who were you going to see at that time?
So I'd gone through the whole kind of thing of bands like The Pretenders and Susie and the Banshees, and just the post-punk stuff is all coming through. I'd fallen madly in love with Joy Division and New Order, There was a wee band at the time called Joining the Self Abusers who were playing in Glasgow a lot, and I kind of was mad about their stuff. So go and see them regularly, and as many people will know, that they changed their name to Simple Minds, and their early stuff is still brilliant. It is brilliant, really brilliant. But it was a real fantastic scene because at the other side of it, you had Orange Juice, and you had Aztec Camera coming through, and you had all the postcardy stuff coming through. And by this time, I'm completely lost on Peely, and I'm listening to all this stuff. And it was just a really quite magical time in Glasgow. I mean, there was one summer, Loco and the Commotions had an album out at a time, Rattlesnakes. And just everybody was just hanging about in summer, listening to Rattlesnakes or, you know, loads of other brilliant albums that were coming. And Glasgow was pretty damn fabulous at the time for upcoming stuff. But it didn't stop me because I loved all the kind of, the bands like the Bunnymen were coming up, Cure. Seen the Cure really early and I loved them. It's first album. I bought Faith. I loved Faith. So there's so much happening. So music's great. You're, as usual, that is your mother in love. I'm playing football. The football starts going really well. I end up getting player of the year in the first season with Clyde. I didn't think I would even get a game. We won our league. I ended up getting drafted into the Scottish under-18s. We won the European Championships. I got player of the tournament. I then got player of the year for the division. And I'm going, steady on, slow down here. I'm not, this is not what I was expecting. I just want to play for fun.
Well, you mentioned Simple Minds there, and we're both huge fans of early Simple Minds. Did you become friends with the band? Did you get to know Jim Kerr and Charlie Birchall? Because, I mean, you've got very similar backgrounds. I think Jim is a little bit older than you, but very similar background.
Never met at the time. I did later. And oddly, quite a few years later, maybe 7 or 8 years later. I mean, still, they were doing well. It was pretty sparkling rain sort of time. Maybe when I was just kind of leaving them behind. And I used to just meet Jim on flights all the time. Because we'd go to Glasgow in London, and after games for Chelsea, I'd fly back up and see my friends or whatever in Glasgow or Edinburgh. And couldn't believe how many times Jim was on the flight. We just sat having a chat and got on really well. I've met sort of the other members to passing. But I kind of didn't want to, they weren't my hangabout mates. And then by that time, I'd moved on to other things, you know. Like one of my best pals by that time was Simon Raymond from the Cocteau Twins and Big Richard Jobson, Once of Skids, and many other things since. So you kind of, but Jim was just cool, just a good lad. I remember sitting about 3 sentences in for the first time I met Jim and thinking, yeah, we're just mates. All right. There's none of this or that sort of stuff. Just really good mates. But at the time, I wouldn't have hung about waiting for bands after a gig. No, you watched a band, you loved a band, and you went back. But it was a great, that first period in Glasgow, I mean, some of the best things I've ever seen in my life, still to this day. Now, part of it's because you're young, of course. I remember the very, very early New Order stuff. They played a live gig in Edinburgh once. And I remember them playing, I think, The Procession, and everything's going green for the first time, and thinking, right, that's wow. It's just punch you in the face, brilliant. And thought they were absolutely stunning. But similarly, I remember seeing Simple Minds again in Edinburgh, and they released their new album, which was New Gold Dream. Having loved all their stuff before that, and then watching it, me and my 3 mates going, oh, well, that's them huge then. But, I mean, you just knew it immediately. You thought, oh, well, they're going to be gigantic then. And they're in that crossover thing. So it was lovely. I remember going to see The Fall quite a bit around about then. Peely was talking a lot about it. I kind of, took me a wee while to get The Fall. I was kind of happy I stuck with it. I mean, the first time I seen them, I hated them. Hex Induction Hour Tour. I mean, I just absolutely didn't get it at all. But, you know, we could span forever the bands that I was going to see at the time. A lot of small bands as well. But, you know, at the same time, I remember having tickets to see Bob Marley and the Wailers, which would be great. But there was a game on that night.
Oh.
I was captain. What do you do?
What did you do?
Well, the day before, Bob took ill. And they said they'd redo it and come back again. So I didn't have to take the decision. And then Bob never came back.
Oh, no.
So I never got to see him again. But, I mean, all through those years, it was a lot of bands that you'd go and see that were sort of bigger names and smaller names. And some of them you love to death, but they your own wee favourite band that nobody else kind of followed. But it didn't matter because it was just a joy learning all these new bands and new things. And of course, you always had the NME or whatever Melody Maker, usually NME for me, and Peely. And most importantly, all your mates sharing tapes. Mm. Remember one guy, I was at college with, and he came up, I've got a single. He goes, you're going to love this. I kind of didn't know him that well, but he was one of the kind of guys, really geeky guy. And I kind of knew that we liked sort of the same stuff. And he said, look, just take that single. I bought two because I know you'll like it. First single by this band. Just got home and I played it. And it didn't sound like anything else I'd heard. And I just thought, I'm going to love this band forever. And I do. And I always have loved Jurati Caller ever since that moment. And so it was the very first single by Jurati Caller, another factory band. And again, Vinnie Reilly became, over the years, a great friend. Actually wrote a song for me called Shirt Number 7.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, on his album. So that was that, you know, early days. But what then happened is, because that first season went brilliantly well, Chelsea came in to buy me.
Yeah, so you're 19 when Chelsea signed you. So this is 1983. So you're leaving this amazing music culture in Glasgow to move down to London. What were your impressions of London at that time? Did you go out much? Did you, you know, was it like an opening up, or, you know, how did you feel about that move?
Right. Well, first of all, there's a little bridge between it because Chelsea tried to sign me and I said no for a year, which people thought I was mad, but I wanted to try and finish the degree and I was really happy in Glasgow. Why move? But after that year, they came back in another year and pleaded. So I took a 2-year sabbatical and went down. Part of it was you get to see more bands in London. Everybody plays London. Lots of people play Glasgow, but everybody plays London. And I went down and I remember going down the train thinking, who would I love to meet in London? Come on, I mean, you know, it's like if people don't live in London, seeing you going down, London has got everything. It just really has got everything. All the famous people, all the bands you love, all the, you know, cinema you want to see, all the theatre, you name it. It's all the everything's in London. And I was just thinking of all the gigs I was going to see and all the people I met. And actually, one of them was, I wonder if I'll ever meet John Peel one day. And of course, fast forward 3 or 4 years and we were great friends. Which is a long story, which is for another day. But I went down there. I'd say the first few months were not difficult because I actually got into the Chelsea's team amazingly, very, very quickly. You think about, I'm 19, skinny wee rake. I was bought for 95 grand, which was nothing. Buttons, right?
Yeah.
So no expectations. But I got into the team and just, as I say, first season got player of the year. And you're like, and at start, I'll tell you the honest problem was, I was skin, absolutely skin. I was on 180 quid a week. The flat was 100 quid a week. You have to pay tax. That doesn't leave you much to eat. So I wasn't really getting out that much. I was listening in, sitting in at night, watching telly, listening to Peely, you know, going for runs, just being normal, trying to get the odd night out, but not being able to really afford it much. And then when I got in the first team, we started winning games. And when we won games, the win bonus was more than I earned. So, and I can remember there was 1 week, we won three away games in a row. I remember one of them was against Leicester. And Lineker was playing for them and we battled them. And I got 3 win bonuses. And I think I got 900 quid or something like that. And I was like, these record shops, I've got to get battered now. And from then on in, I was very fortunate that I could do the things I wanted to do. I could afford to do the things I wanted to do. I could afford to go and see the bands. And London at that point in time, we've got a few quid. I mean, I wouldn't. Wealthy or anything. I just had that. I mean, I'm still a student at heart, and indeed still am. But I've got enough money to do what I want. And that means going to see gigs. And that means sometimes traveling outside London. Sometimes. So the list of bands I've seen in that first 2 or 3 years in London was just extraordinary. And of course, being quite nondescript and small, and before the time of mobile phones, I'd go and see gigs on Friday nights before a Saturday game for Chelsea. Absolutely. Didn't bother me that at all. As I often said to people, going to see Strawberry Switchblade at the ICA, I don't think it's going to kick off. You know, so I think I'll be all right. Tell you one night summed up London very quickly. I ended up getting interviewed by the NME. When no footballers had ever been interviewed by the NME before. And he did this double praise spread because Adrian, who was writing for them, had found that there was actually a footballer who liked Joy Division. Now, this was very unusual in those days, as in unbelievably unusual in those days. And who liked The Fall and all that. I was like, what? And it was brilliant. It was lovely. And it opened so many doors. So Adrian ended up becoming my flatmate. And there was this one night we were out and at the Wag Club, which was a hangout place, not really my kind of place, but there was a guy called Slim Gaylor playing, and he was one of the great old jazz musicians. So I like all types of music, by the way. And I'm sitting in there, and Gaylor was brilliant. And he played for Reagan and Kate Hepburn and all that back in that day, you know, wild times of those days in the 30s and 40s. Anyway, I was at the bar with Adrian. The guy bumped me, spilled my drink. Yes, Adrian, what about this arse? Bumped me again. If he does that again, I'm going to have a word. Bumped me. Turn around and have a word. It was David Bowie. I thought, actually, I'll just leave that. I'm not shouting David Bowie. Anyway, he bumped me again. I said to Adrian, I'll have a word with his mate, right? And tell him his mate, could you tell your mate to calm down a bit? So he bumped me again. I turned right to his mate, Jagger. Nah, just forget it. Because the brilliant thing about certain places in London, the Wag was one of them. Nobody bothered you. Nobody bothered you. You didn't matter what you did. So with these lovely times of seeing great art, great music, great theatre, and things were going well for me in Chelsea.
Wasn't it the time of playing for Chelsea that you infamously asked to be substituted during a friendly match?
Yeah, you and I probably don't think this is a very unusual thing at all, or a very silly thing. It was there was two gigs down at the Royal Festival Hall in a couple of days, within a couple of 8 days. One of them was Cocteau's and one of them was New Order. And Chelsea were playing again that one of the evenings. I wanted to go see the gig. So I said to the manager, can I sub me at half time? You know, I could get to see the gig. And he's like, and I was just about to sign a new contract with him. And I was like, you know, I'll probably sign a contract if you let me do it. And of course, that sounds totally wild. The added thing you need to know about it was a post-season friendly. I wouldn't have done it for a league game. I wouldn't have done it for a cup game. But post-season friendly, I mean, you know, it's Brentford. You know, I don't need any fitness. It's there to make money for people. I've done there and done my bit, played for half of the game. But yeah, it did go down. I'm sure it was New Order, it wasn't Cocteau's, because they both played one night, one the next night. And I went down with my kit underneath my big black gloom boom coat and my black jacket and all the rest of it. And it was a great gig. It was fantastic. In fact, I still have the tape of that gig to this day.
Ah, really?
Because I was one of these people who used to tape it in Iowa.
How did your teammates feel about your extra activities? Because, you know, you are known for being sort of the indie footballer. I think, am I right in thinking Brian McClair sort of shared similar-ish taste to you?
Yeah, it was similar-ish taste, but just we shared something bigger than that, which was we don't give a shit. We are ourselves. We're not going to try and be like you. I'm just going to be myself. Now, within any workforce, and slight serious moment for a second, there's always a pressure to fit in. There's always a pressure to be a wee bit like everybody else, to be liked and all the rest of it. Brian and I had that gene removed at birth. We don't care. We just do what we want to do. Right? And if while we're chatting here, if anyone's listening, just go and Google a picture of Brian McClure just now and you'll see Brian. We do what we want, right? And you should be respected for your interests. And a classic was, like, there was a period like early days in Chelsea. My nickname was Weirdo for them because I was an outsider. Now people think, oh, that's terrible. I think it was said with affection. It really was. Mostly because you just not like us. You're weird. And I would say things like, I think you're still getting it wrong, lads. I'm normal. You're all weird. That's the point. You're all weird. And I really believed that. And I think I'm right still. But yeah, I did have different interests in them. It didn't mean I disliked them. It meant I didn't hang about a lot with them afterwards. But there's more than just humour or theatre or the arts. You know, there's more than just music. Humour's a great thing. And a lot of the lads had brilliant kind of Python-esque humour.
Mm.
A number of them did. Colin Pates, Johnny Bumstead. And some of them are just straight up decent blokes. So, and now and again, the difficult point was the journeys in the bus, because early days, they put music on, which would give me a headache. There was only so much wham I could take. And it was just before Sony Walkmans had come in.
Mm.
I mean, Sony Walkman changed my life.
Mm. Just
put out one, journey's fine. But then I started making tapes for the bus that was that very, very tiny little area where I could put up with and they could put up with. It was like in a little sliver of an area where they would put up with, and then I'd get bored and put on some weird fall drag. And then get that shit off.
So in that time period, we're talking, you know, the Smiths are getting very, very big at this point. And we mentioned Vinnie Reilly earlier. You've told me in private this fantastic story in the past, but maybe you can share it with our listeners.
Well, I mean, Vinnie Reilly, I deeply, deeply, deeply adore Juretti Colin and still do. I mean, to anybody out there who's not heard Juretti Colin's first, I'm going to say any albums, but start at the start, they're brilliant. It's so beautiful. But I kind of seen the Smiths very early on. Adrian, my flatmate, had got tickets, and he was a big pusher of Smiths. Adrian was famous because he wrote a brilliant, very early piece about Scottish music called Why Do Jocks Jangle? Which is a great line. Come on. They do. Jangly, jangly, orange juice and all the rest of it. It's fantastic, really brilliant. Joseph Kay, all that sort of stuff. But he also was very early on in Smiths. And I went to see him in Reading, of all places. And I quite liked the Smiths. I'd have watched, if you gave me the Smiths and Cocteau, I'm Cocteau all day long, or New Order or whatever. There was lots of band. But, you know, the Smiths, really good at the time. But a few years later, I actually did write and edited this version of this in my first book. And it was, I was playing for Everton, and Vinny, who I became great friends with by then, oh, well spotted, you've got it there. what's that one called? I can't remember.
The Accidental Footballer.
So I was friends with Vinny by this time. You're living up in the Northwest. And Vinny just said to me one night, do you want to go out and see my friend? And we'll go to his house for a wee meeting up. And I went, all right, what's his name? He goes, oh, Stephen. I went, Stephen? Yeah, Stephen Patrick. Right, so we're going to see Morrissey then. He went, yeah, yeah. Because Morris, he'd kind of part written some of Morris's first solo album. And so went along, it was to go along, and just before leaving that day for training at Everton, I said to the lads, do you know where Bowden is? And Norman Whiteside said, I know where Bowden is, I live in Bowden. I said, do you know where Bowden Road is? He goes, I live in Bowden Road. And I'm going to see a friend of mine tonight. And he goes, oh, I'll come along, little girl, and get pissed. Norman Whiteside, famed drinker at the time, hulky footballer. So I never did meet up with Norman that night, but went round to Moz's house with Vinny. We had the most brilliant night. And I, again, could tell stories on for the next hour and a half about how lovely an evening and what's weird things. But my favourite bit was we went upstairs and the beautiful baby grand piano sitting there. And to which Vinny, who's a classically trained pianist, said to Moz, I didn't know you played. And he goes, I didn't. I bought it you for this evening for us so that you could play for us. I thought it would be delightful. Typical Moz line. Who buys a piano for an evening? So that one of the nice things, I suppose, about I'm never in awe of famous people, never have been. Even people I admire greatly for their art and their skills or whatever. You can't really be that way if you play football, because you'll end up playing against somebody. I can remember I played against Ken Dalglish. Now, as a kid, Ken Dalglish was a star. And now I'm playing against him, I can't be in awe of him. He's just a bloke. And I kind of felt that way about everybody I met. And I'm very fortunate over the years. So whether it be Morrissey or Matt Johnson or Saddam Hussein, who I also met.
That was on a football tour, wasn't it?
It wasn't a football tour, which was absolutely mental.
Was that playing for Everton or Scotland?
That was Chelsea.
Oh, it was Chelsea.
Yeah, Chelsea. We ended up going to Iraq, and the game was delayed 45 minutes because the guest of honour hadn't turned up, and we didn't know who he was. And it turned up to be Saddam, because we were playing in Iraq. Even we were in Baghdad. And of course, the madness of things like that happening, players, they have no idea of the cultural significance of it. But because I was kind of sort of read different newspapers and listened to different things, some of the things that I look at as completely and utterly mad, it just kind of floated over a lot of their heads. Just, no, we're here to play football. We don't care. Mm. Not interested. So that was, again, one of the great joys of playing football. It gives you a chance. You make a couple of quid. Not the money they make these days. Not a multi-millionaire like the modern players, but you get enough to get by. You can go and see what you want to go and see. You get the opportunity to travel. And I'm a fanatical traveller.
So how was that move from Chelsea to Everton for you? Because so you're leaving London, moving to Liverpool. Did that affect the bands and music you were listening to at the time?
Well, not initially, because when Liverpool's got a good scene. I stayed halfway basically between Manchester and Liverpool. So between the two of them, we get plenty going on. There's lots of different bands. I mean, remember going to see the Blue Nile, who I deeply adore in Manchester, but lots of bands were coming to Liverpool as well. Easier to go to Manchester if you're an Everton player, because, you know, if you're walking down Lord Street and you play for Everton or Liverpool, if you walk down the main street of Liverpool, main street in Liverpool, and you're an Everton Liverpool player and you're with Tom Cruise, they'll ignore Tom Cruise, right? That's just the way it is, right? So, and I'm not mad on the kind of fame bit. It doesn't interest me greatly. I don't mind people saying hello, but it just has no, it's so too superficial. So I would spend more time out in Manchester. And of course, Manchester had the factory, got, you know, Tony Wilson, and met up with some of the older lads sometimes as well. So there was a lot going on. Could get down to London sometimes as well. But quite soon after that, got married and had children. And that was a really weird time for me musically, because Manchester's just happening.
Mm.
And I'm on the doorstep, and I'm a regular visitor of the Hacienda just before it's about to hit. And I don't take part in it at all.
So how many years are you kind of checked out musically?
So I'm not checked out completely, because I'm still listening to people's show and taping it, but it's much harder to go to gigs now.
And is this the period where you're sitting in on John Peel's shows?
No, that was, I'd done that before when I was in London. So the last three or four years in London, where I got to know Peely, and I got to know him after interviewing him for a newspaper I was writing for. I was writing for the Chelsea Football Club newspaper, but I was writing a music column. as obviously I would. I ended up interviewing John. We got on really well, and we ended up hanging out. When the show would be going on, and I'd be sitting there with a couple of other friends. You'd call them interns now, but they were just mates at the time. And some of them, one of them, Padgett, but she's still one of my best friends. And you have to take down the details so that they could get the payments. And you know, Peely's show was a mess. There's records everywhere, and most of them are white labels, half of them are cassettes. So shambles trying to organise it. But we just laughed and laughed and laughed. It was brilliant. And of course, it was Joyce being in there. And of course, very similar to myself, John and I had one big thing in common. We did not have any time for this, the fame bit. We were not interested. We were people who were in an industry that had that, but we just were in it for the love of the art. So I was in it for the art of football, and he was in it for the art of music. But we both happened to like each other's things. I liked the music and he liked the football as well. So he never really mentioned me very much.
Mm.
That was in. He'd sometimes say, oh, the famous footballer's in tonight, but people wouldn't know because he knew that that sort of thing would annoy me. Not annoy me, but it's not what I wanted.
So later on, you make the move to Tranmere. So you're still on Merseyside. And I remember you saying this was some of the happiest days of your life playing professional football. Why was that? What was so different from the environment at Everton and Chelsea?
It's not, see, that sounds as if it's to denigrate Everton and Chelsea. It's not. It's just because they were all good and fun and enjoyable times. The Tranmere 4 years was because it's more normal. I didn't feel stress. I've never felt pressure. I've never been nervous. But it was easy, fun, friendly. The fun part was more to the fore. I kind of liked the banter. I then realised that actually, I'm going to be a footballer now. I'd been one for about 8 years and then I realised, shit, that's my job. I do that now. Actually, I might as well just start enjoying it a wee bit. So, not enjoying it, but relaxing into it a bit even more, which I did. Played some great football. That's all that mattered to me. So I'd dropped one, they were one division below the, so the championship, you call it now. And we were up the top of the championship the whole time. Tranmere were a good team, right good team at the time. Nearly got promoted to the Premier League time and again. I played more times for Scotland while I was at Tranmere than all my other clubs added together. So I was playing good football. And that's a big part of it. Playing good football, enjoying it, good people around you. Fans are lovely, absolutely lovely people. And you just had lovely, early, married, children, fun time. You know, it's got its own pressures, but, you know, and with family difficulties, but it was just great. It was kind of beautiful. And I kind of loved that that period. At that point in time, began to get to see some gigs again, which was really good. I remember that time. I mean, lots of gigs, but I have to admit, one that really jumped out was Radiohead's OK Computer Tour, which was, you know, so much. But by, even by then, because I bought Pablo Honey and I got the Bends, but I hadn't seen them live. And I remember thinking, God, they'll be too big now. I'm not like this, you know, Mr. Snob. And then being absolutely and utterly blown away, you know. And yeah, it felt like a modern day Floyd stroke Dark Side of the Moon sort of thing going on. Didn't matter, it was brilliant. So there was at that point in time still great stuff. Keeping in the ball with the smaller bands was still something that I was doing as much as possible, and lots of bands coming through. And around about that time, Scottish music was getting interesting again.
Say, Bill and Sebastian?
Yes. And really early days. I remember, because I'll hear about this. And the reason being is because my mates in Scotland, finger on the pulse, I'm listening a lot, Peely's playing. I'm not going to miss it. So really early days, Bells, and thinking, wow. And by the time the Boy with the Arrow Strap came out, I'm thinking, oh God, they've sold out. You know, and I wish they hadn't.
Their new gold dream moment.
Exactly. It felt not quite new. It wasn't new gold dream moment because it wasn't over ultra produced quite to that level, but the songs were still phenomenal. But I'd been buying the singles and, you know.
But I think there is that thing of, you know, when a band is yours and they get bigger, and you sort of worry about, you know, the band sort of getting away from you. I think we've all experienced that with different bands.
We have. And sometimes it's you and sometimes it's the band.
You know, there are certain bands that I'll come back to. You know, you might sort of dip out for a little bit, but then who knows why you sort of reconnect with them later in life. But just going back to sort of the 97 period, you take on this extra responsibility of being the chairman of the Professional Footballers Association. How did that happen?
He gone, thrust on. You joking? No, I didn't want to be, a lot of my things, didn't want to be a footballer, ended up being a footballer. I was on the management committee of the PFA. I didn't want to be on the management committee. I didn't even want to be a union rep, but they kept on saying, do this, please do this. Nobody else is doing, please do this. Anyway, eventually the chairmanship of the PFA comes up and I said, well, I'm definitely not doing that. So we were at the meeting. It was about maybe 9, 10, 11, 12, I can't remember, reps there who are on the management committee. And we need to choose a chairman from that. So Gordon Taylor goes around the table and says, right, do you want to do it? Brian McLeod was on it. He went, not Brian McLeod. It was Cammy. A number of players went, Gary Mabbott, a couple of others.
Ian Dowie, yeah.
Ian Dowie. Can you go around the table? They're all saying, no. Comes to Lonnie Sanchez. And I said, I'll do it. So I'm saying, oh, at least we've got somebody now. Gordon Taylor's kicking me under the table because I'm sitting beside Gordon Taylor and he's going, somebody has to go against him. Well, why? Because you need to make it a challenge. So I'm going around the table, it's getting closer to us. Gets to Brian McLeod, who's sitting next to me. No. So I say, right, I'll throw my hat in the ring, but only because you're supposed to have a vote. I would like to make it very clear to everybody around this table, I am not interested in this job, okay? I do not want to be chairman of the PFA, but we have to have a vote. So along with Laurie, I'll put my name in, right? So I think I won 11-1 in the vote. Oh, thank you, you gets. So I was saying that was thrust onto me as well. But there's another side to me. I'm a union man at heart and I want to help my fellow workers. And I did learn a lot. It was harsh and hard to work. And sometimes it took a lot, it was more of my time than I wanted it to. And when things happened, because there was a strike ballot at the time against the Premier League, which was very stressful for everybody in football. And we won, which was great. There was the night that Eric Cantona kung fu kicked a supporter. And guess who was supposed to stand up and argue for our player of the year, Eric Cantona, our PFA player. And I don't know about you, but see this whole concept of defending the indefensible. So things like that. And they almost get dragged on to do Newsnight with Paxman. That one, which is not a good idea. I mean, I learned a lot and I kind of had background because of the degree I'd done that I could do that sort of stuff. But, you know, I'd started writing quite a lot there. I was writing for newspapers and magazines. I'd been writing for music magazines for years under assumed names. So it's just as you're going along, there's interesting things. And of course, at that point, you have to realise it doesn't last forever, football. So you need to do something else.
Well, speaking of jobs you didn't want to do, after a spell at Kilmarnock, you move on to Motherwell and you were both player and chief executive, which is not the most normal combination.
Completely unique combination, unheard of. And it was, if I've ever done a hard job in my life, that's the only one I've done that was hard. The playing's fine, but chief executive and playing and running a club and trying to structure a club and trying to work with all sides of it, manager, players. Players were fine generally, most of the time. The chairman, the disagreements, the board, the politics, none of which I can be arsed with. And for a while it was brilliant fun. And for a while we got to the third best team in Scotland really quite quickly, within a space of a year. Built it up really well, built up a brilliant youth development. And then the owner decided to pull the plug on the money, which was an extraordinary, a nice second book, Football and How to Survive It. That deals with my Tranmere years and the year at Kilmarnock and Motherwell years. And the stories in that, the amount of people that say, come up to me after reading that book and say, I wouldn't have believed it possible that those things happen. And they are hilarious. The stories in that are hilarious. And that was maybe the first time ever I really felt terrible, awful stress, because the stress wasn't for me. The stress was for the other people who depended on you. But it was an extraordinary thing to do. At that point in time, really about then and a few years afterwards, my life was saved by music and clubs in Glasgow.
Oh, really? So I can only imagine that period of Motherwell was incredibly stressful when working every hour of the day. You know, the club had financial problems, threat of administration.
That wasn't my only two jobs. I was also working for Channel 5. I'd started doing a wee bit for Radio 5 Live. I was writing for newspapers, and I was living an hour and a half away from the ground. So I had full-time jobs, whatever. But the stress of the job at Motherwell was extraordinary at the time. And any time I had to get away, if I went to see a gig or go to little clubs that were playing music and you could meet normal people, it absolutely saved my life. And indeed, for the few years afterwards, when I left that job and I was working in media. It was an absolute lifesaver. I met some of the greatest friends I've ever met in my life in that period, and they were all musical.
So how did you move over into the media from Motherwell? How did that transition come about?
There wasn't a transition. It was always there. So 98, I got asked to work for Five Live. Now this is, I'm still playing for Tranmere, but I asked to work for Five Live at a World Cup. I thought I should have been playing at that World Cup, but I'd been left out of the squad. So I went over as the co-coms and just loved it. It was great. I've done just about every World Cup and Euros since. So I was doing Five Live stuff here and there already then. By the time when I stopped playing Motherwell, the Channel 5 TV had started doing football.
So with all this travelling with your media commitments, do you get time to listen to things while you're driving? You know, is that a good time to dive into a new album or a new genre or something that you may have discovered?
Always was, up until 4 years ago. So the driving was my saviour. And quite often you'd be driving along and you'd be listening to your albums. When we lost Pele, it changed everything because there wasn't John to listen to all the time. He's recorded shows, which are recorded every night. So you would just be listening around and giving things chances and trying to find out new things. Beginning to listen to what my children were saying. They don't really come up with that much that I don't know or I would like or that I don't immediately see where the influence is, because we're older, we know that, we can see where they're coming from. But I get some of that as well. So for a long time, and then it was a period of time where I was doing a bit more DJing, where I'd be driving along and in my head I was just making up set lists, which is a great thing, as you will know, to do.
Yeah.
So all that stuff was fine. So I did that for years and years. I've always been a bit of a fan of classical music. So classical music's brilliant to drive to, particularly late at night, which is often, if I do a game, say I'm doing Liverpool v Spurs, and the game finishes at 10, I'm on till 10:30. I'm not in the car till 11. I'm not getting home till 3. So you've got 4 hours there to listen and learn. Then two things happened. Really changed my life a few years ago. Number one was I started writing the books, and I found I cannot listen to music while I write at all. I need silence. And then no music, because what happens is my mind just goes into music and I start listening to it and I got lost in it and the thread's gone. I need total and utter. So when I'm writing, it must be total silence. So that's fine when I'm writing the odd article. You know, if you're 1,000 words, I can get it off in an hour and a half, that's fine. I can do them for newspapers and then you can go and listen to some music. Not with a book. No, I'm afraid not.
So you were writing those books during the COVID pandemic. I remember talking to you, was it before?
Yeah, before. The first one I did before. I started writing it before. And the second one was during COVID. In that period of time, you know, COVID was a bit of a, I was very fortunate. I mean, we had some people had horrendous COVID, so we had a great COVID. Living the Scottish border, we get lovely space, we had time off. I was one of the few people in the country that could travel through the worst of it. So I would drive to London and I'd be the only car on the road because nobody else is allowed on the roads. But some of the very few people, apart from police, was commentators for football games, because the football games were going on. And there was nobody in there, but we had to be in there. So that was a weird, mad, strange time where I remember going to London and getting there in 5 hours. It usually takes me 7.5. I remember driving into Soho once and was nobody but there. There wasn't any cars. There was nobody parking. It was like a movie. It was extraordinary to walk through it and just get out and walk about.
So what can you tell us about the third one? Has it been written?
Yeah. So the third one, I don't know when I'll bring it out. I'll see when I feel like it. The third one was the one I wanted to write first, which is funnier. The other ones have got humour in them, plenty of humour in them. But this one is basically the part of my life after I stopped playing football and the weird things that happened there. And considering I'll be every World Cup, two weeks ago I was in Munich, last week was Bruges, and tomorrow I'm off to Athens. And while I'm there, I have adventures. Things happen. And I've kept all those stories. So that's the one that I wanted to write and first, because that's the fun one. And the problem is editing that one down. That's a real problem, because there's too much, far, far too much there. So but the problem is, to go back to your original question, was listening to music and learning and finding new stuff has actually been a bit of a disaster to me for the last 4 years. It's really, really bad. It really upset me and it worried me, and it was really like an itch that I couldn't scratch. It was really annoying. And then my wife said one day, it won't go away, you know. The music will be made and you will hear it. You may not see the band live when they're young, but you'll find it if you want to find it when the time's right. So that's what I did. I thought, no, okay, I'll relax. So I'm a bit behind, and usually you and I would have these talks up until the last 3 or 4 years, and you'd be giving me new stuff and I'd give you new stuff. You more than me, because you live in the world. But the last 3 or 4 years have been tougher for that, for me, to be honest. I've put it off to get back in. I'm still going to see gigs.
So who have you seen recently?
Oh, God, I need to ask me that. I need to look up my diary. Do you know what? I went to see the Spook School Reform.
Ah, the reunion.
Yeah, I went to see that, which was great. But I went to see Wilco a wee bit recently, which really kind of knocked me out, because I remember seeing them first 2 or 3 albums, and they have gone very different directions, but yeah, pretty good. Got to see the again.
Oh, amazing.
And I'm a big Matt Johnson fan. Now, you know, Soul Mining and Infected, but particularly Soul Mining, is one of the greatest albums ever made, I think. And I remember going to see them when Johnny Marr was in the band. And that sticks out there, still one of the best things I've ever seen in my entire life. And it wasn't that, it wasn't as good as that, but it was still fabulous to be there and see Matt doing so well. And what that really jumps out, and really, really jumps out about Matt Johnson, try listening to the lyrics of Soul Mining and try and think, is that today that they were written? Were they written yesterday afternoon? It's extraordinary. It is like, now you couldn't see the future, obviously, but if you are thinking about, you know, the state of the world and how people react to each other, et cetera, it's amazing how prescient so many, I mean, even just the phrase, is this the 51st state of the USA, in one of these big singles. We're still talking about that, but only Canada's talking about it, we're not. But there's also a number of people whose stuff I have never heard, but I need to hear. But it's okay, I know who they are and I know who I need to hear.
Well, Pat, thank you so much for today.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks to Pat Nevin for joining us today, whose importance to Scatterdance cannot be underestimated. You can hear him on BBC Radio 5 Live and keep an eye out for his new book. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe, and you can follow us on social media at Scatterdance for news on our events. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week talking to the musician and composer Warren Ellis. We'll be talking about Ellis Park, the acclaimed documentary about the wildlife sanctuary he has co-founded in the forests of Sumatra, as well as his music career. This podcast was recorded and produced at Third Floor Recording.